Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gourvani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. We are very excited that we have another special episode, and I want to give a shout out. We asked you to write in with some of the topics you'd like to hear about. We heard you wanted to hear more about water, and we heard that you wanted to hear more about housing. So I'll let
you
introduce our
guest. Here we go. We have in studio with us the Senior Advisor of Housing Strategy and Innovation for Governor Cox, Steve Waldrop. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Natalie. And
yeah, we love having you. You're like the top guy for housing in the state. What's that like?
Well, it's really scary considering how little I actually know. But it is it's a great calling to be a part of because it is, I think, one of the top one or two issues. And I think you just mentioned both water and housing, and they intertwine. And so being able to work on this critical issue and think about the future of our state, the future prosperity of our kids and grandkids, and what are they going to inherit from us? How are we going to provide this life that we have come to enjoy? How can we transfer that wealth and benefit to them is really what drives me.
Okay. Well, that's a philosophical statement that I'm interested in. But will you back it up a little bit and tell our listeners a little bit about your path into this work? You've served in the legislature, a little bit about your path into politics, and maybe just a little bit about where'd you grow up?
Oh, I'm one of those Californicators that we all love to hate. I came from California. I grew up in Southern California in the shadow of Disneyland, I like to say.
Okay.
Went to BYU.
I got a question for you.
Oh, go ahead.
Did you grow up in a single family home? What kind of housing did you grow up in?
Grew up in a very lovely, probably 3,000 square foot home, which at the time was huge. In California.
Yeah.
We had six kids. My parents, my father was a lawyer and a judge, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom all growing up. So
yeah.
I had the best, you know, kind of that best life growing up, opportunities that came with that, and came to Utah, undergrad at BYU, went to law school at the U. Everybody hates me for going to one or the other. Nobody loves me for the one I went to. Then I went to University of Washington and got a master's in tax law. Thought I was going to practice law. I did it for 9 whole months.
It was
a really scarring experience. I saw really quickly that this isn't what I wanted my life's work to be.
Yeah.
And so after a lot of school and a lot of debt and passing the bar and quit and came to Utah to work for the Boyer Company. So I spent 14 years working for the Boyer Company doing primarily industrial real estate.
Okay.
So no housing involved at all. Just did development structuring largely. My legal background helped a lot in structuring deals, and I found that was where one of my talents lay, creating structural solutions and looking at pieces and parts and putting them together and saying, what can we do to make this work and create those opportunities? And had success at Boyer doing that. Left to be a little less busy. Then I got involved in politics, sadly, for some,
Probably mostly you and those around you.
So I spent 4 years in the House. In the meantime, I had...
What area did you represent?
Eden.
Oh, okay.
Ogden
so
Valley.
We're in the Huntsville kind
Huntsville,
of...
Huntsville, Eden, Liberty, North Ogden.
That's a happening
Harrisville.
Place.
Yeah. My wife and I can't talk about housing and growth because we are pretty much on opposite ends of the spectrum on, you know, she grew up in Ogden Valley. She grew up in Huntsville.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit before the show about how that sense of loss of what used to be, and she feels that very acutely in the Valley. And I know a lot of people in Utah have that feeling as well.
Yeah. And that's an area of the state that our listeners, I think a lot of our listeners are probably connected to, but I am stunned. I go up there maybe once a year. I find myself up there. It is changing so quickly over the last decade and even just in the last few months, kind of being up in the kind of Morgan, like driving through. I imbibe, unusual for some of the other folks who are on the show, but the Shooting Star is like a fun place to zip up to in the summer, and just to see the way it's changed right around that area is immense. There's been immense change that way.
Interesting.
The Shooting Star is a great place.
I know.
Steve, let's go to housing a little bit and tell us. So the governor asked you to do this. Did you hesitate? This is the first time someone was in this position. It was an inaugural position, am I right?
Yeah, they created a new position, and I had left the legislature, decided not to run for reelection, had served 4 years and thought, that's a good amount of service in public service, and I was going back, and one of the things I had done while I was in the legislature and a little previous to that is helped co-found a social benefit fund to help teachers, beginning with teachers and civil servants, get into home ownership.
Yeah.
And so I became really involved in that. And in my last 2 years in the legislature, I was the chair on the Commission on Housing Affordability. And so I started learning about housing policy. I started to learn the value of that sense of place people get when they have a home of their own.
Yeah.
And that really kind of cemented my philosophical drive toward home ownership. And so I left the legislature. I was going to go back to that nonprofit and work there and spend all my time there. And then the governor called and said, "We're creating a new position. Do you know anybody just like you that would take that position?"
That's a tough
call. And I said, "Well, would you consider me?" I thought I was volunteering, to be perfectly honest. I didn't think it was a real job. Uh-huh. And I found out very shortly afterward, it's an actual real job.
You serve on his cabinet, all that kind of thing.
And there's, and it's a lot of time, but it's great work. It's something that I share the passion of the governor for the creation of starter homes and for that opportunity that we're trying to pass on to this next generation. We don't want to be the first generation that has that passes on less wealth to our kids than we had.
Yeah. Some people call that the American dream or the Utah
Absolutely.
Dream. And Shireen, are you okay if we just unpack this a little bit?
Yeah, I'm really interested in that. I think there are some sort of big questions I have, like, why is sense of place so important? Why is the sense of home so important? I'd love mm-hmm. to like kind of talk about that a little bit, but let's talk about it from more of the policy perspective.
Well,
too.
How big of a problem is it? What's our shortage? What's the real problem of having a housing so unaffordable? I mean, I think I know the answer to that, but I want to hear you express it as the guy that advises our governor.
There's a lot of metrics and a lot of statistics you can quote. The one that I think is probably the most impactful today is that 90% of the people that don't own a home in Utah right now cannot afford to buy a home. And so when you think about 9 out of 10 Utahns, and these are people coming out of college, they're coming out of high school, they're trade school, they're working. When I came into the world out of education, the expectation was, oh yeah, you go buy a home, you're going to go, for us was start a family where, you set down roots, you start to get permanent. And there's a real difference in the younger generations now. They don't have that expectation.
Yeah. Or opportunity.
Yeah. Because they know.
Yeah.
The median age of the first time home buyer in the United States just hit 40.
Yeah. And you can say it another way. The only way really that our young people can get into a home is if someone helps them.
Absolutely. And there are precious few that can.
Yeah. And then if someone helps them, that usually means they have family wealth. That means they came from wealth and they're perpetuating wealth. But there's a whole cohort of young Utahns that will delay home ownership a decade or more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that highlights Utah is the number one state for social mobility. And that's one of the things I think, Shireen, you were asking about, like, what is the impact of this?
Yeah.
We are really, really good at social mobility. People coming in at a low socioeconomic index, going to school, getting a degree, going to trade school, getting their life on track and working and becoming wealthy and having that generational wealth. And that is what is at risk.
Yeah. And I think there's some indicators that it's already slipping, right? There was a report last year about increased debt that Utahns are taking on. And I think for me, I think about it through the lens of, I'm really interested in some of these books over the last few years, like Evicted, like Poverty in America, where I think there is such a very clear direct line between, and this is why redlining and sort of all of the ways in which people of color have been kept out of housing perpetuates this disparity when we think about who has the opportunity to build wealth in this country. I am very passionate about the idea that we need to get people into home ownership. I grew up poor. I was lucky that I don't even know how it happened, but my mom and dad managed to scrape together enough money. I was born in an apartment, lived in an apartment in Bismarck, North Dakota. But by the time I was 2, we lived in a house. And that house that was the core stability in my life, like in my family life, through a lot of things that were really unstable. And I do believe that ultimately the reason I've had the ability to buy the home that I, first bought when I was in my 20s was because my mom was able to help me because she had a home. And like we had just, that kind of opportunity. And for me, the barriers are pale in comparison to other folks. And I'm really excited to hear you talk about this in a way that is thinking about the generational impact, thinking about what housing, stable housing, does to disrupt cycles of poverty. I'm really interested in this.
We've got about a minute left in this segment, so we'll continue this conversation quite a bit. But why aren't we building enough homes?
It's a combination of factors. So we had the great crash of, you know, the great recession that followed 2008, 2009. We stopped building homes nationwide, not just in Utah, but nationwide. Small home builders went out of business. Small contractors went out of business. As the market started to recover in 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, and through today, we have fewer contractors, particularly small local contractors that used to make up 60 to 70% of what was built in Utah, and that's no longer the case. So we've lost some of that expertise and capacity in the market through that process, and throw into it interest rate issues today. We have interest rates that are at historic normal levels, but because they were preceded by these really low interest rates, we had a drive up in pricing. We have pressures on
tariffs,
on materials. We have pressures on labor with immigration. So we have a lot of pressures that are making the economics really, really difficult for the creation of new housing.
Yeah.
Let's take a short break and we'll come back. We're talking about housing. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and Steve Waldrop. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gorbani on the left.
And Natalie Gochner in the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and we have special guest Steve Waldrop in studio with us. He's the senior advisor for housing strategy and innovation for Governor Cox. Hey, what's Governor Cox like? What would you tell our listeners about our good governor?
What I would say is that he is as he appears to be.
Okay.
It's not an act. It's when we saw him after the Charlie Kirk tragedy, that was the real Governor Cox. That was Spencer Cox, who had been raised by good people and came from a great place and cares deeply about the humanity of our state and the people in our state and their ability to prosper and thrive and not have to fight the headwinds of all of the negativity that's afflicting us right now. You see his push on social media and on AI right now. True worry about that because of the impact it has on people. So I would say he is who he appears to be.
Yeah, gives you the support you need.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So in your day-to-day, what are you doing right now to help with housing? And I asked this, Shireen and Steve, with the idea that I think of housing as fundamentally a private sector activity.
Yeah.
I don't think government has a great track record. Someone was mentioning to me the other day the council housing in London. And I just, you know, we see it here too, but public housing doesn't have a good track record.
We tried it in America and it failed. We had these massive public works projects, public housing projects, and we've torn most of them down across the country now and replaced them. And one of the reasons I think is that, and I struggle with this a little bit with the ongoing federal programming, is that it tends to concentrate poverty into silos.
Mm-hmm.
And we know there's no question that the most healthy communities are economically diverse communities.
Integrated. Mm-hmm.
And integrated communities. And the children from integrated communities have opportunities to see. And it's, again, going back to that social mobility. What do they see? What do they learn? If they only see one thing, they will never learn another thing. And so the creation of one of the goals that we have in all of our housing policy is the creation of mixed income communities. So if we're going to do starter homes, let's do them right next to move-up homes, right next to large final homes, right next to condos, right next to townhomes, so that there's the opportunity for people to mix.
How do you define government's role here? You know, if I'm saying that, you know, that building housing is about supply and demand and builders that take risks and, you know, build a great product and, you know, navigate all the complexity. What does government do? I know they permit, but what does government do here?
The fallacy is the notion that we can tax and spend our way out of this, that we can tax ourselves and subsidize our way out of this. There's not enough tax money and tax revenue in the world to solve this problem. It has to be solved by the private sector. And so my goal is to remove the barriers to the private sector, but also to the extent that we can encourage good behavior from the private sector. If you're a developer or a builder and you can build thing A and you make $200,000 on thing A and you can build thing B and you make $20,000, you're always going to build thing A. And those are the most expensive houses. And that's what largely we've been building. We haven't been building the starter homes.
Yeah.
And so when we provide public subsidy or any kind of intervention, we make sure we couple that with a requirement that they build some of thing B. So that again, they're going to make money. We need them to make money. They have to pay their people that then go buy ice cream and go to dance classes and support the economy. We have to have successful private development in the mix. But it has to be, we have to encourage the right type of housing, and that's why we're so focused on those starter homes.
Yeah. So you have a limited incentive dollars, but you put them towards affordable housing.
Attainable housing.
Okay, attainable. Okay, this is good, Shireen. Let's get the definition there. Attainable. Yeah, because affordable's in the eye of the beholder.
Affordable is, and affordable usually comes with a significant public subsidy attached. And we're always going to have the need for affordable housing subsidies. We do it at the federal level. We do it at the state level. But attainable housing is what was once normal, what was once the workforce housing that you graduated, you got a job, you went and bought a house.
It's sugar house.
Yeah, it's sugar house. Uh-huh. It's these areas in our state where you used to be able to get started. And that entry path is now shut off again for 90% of the population of our state. And so we have to find ways to create that entry point into the market again.
This is just so viscerally real. For me, I remember knocking on doors when I first ran for office, and I was knocking a lot of doors around, in and around, I would say like sort of South Salt Lake to North Salt Lake. And in that, I was so surprised. It was such a gift to be able to spend time on doors like that in this community. But I found so many families living intergenerationally, and they were working. They were, you know, the younger and older often were still fully working age, but could not figure out a path. And they couldn't also ever imagine a path with the cost of rent as it was around, you know, many of those areas. So they were, you know, choosing to do this. There are some benefits, I think, to intergenerational living, but there are real challenges when we think about kind of that long term, what it means to build wealth in this country. And I think when I'm listening to you, I'm with you on like most of what you're saying. The questions that I start to have are, clearly there are different interventions for different sectors of individuals, right? So when we think about housing as a form of stabilization for folks that are on our streets that need to move into some sort of stabilization. Obviously, we spend a lot of government, well, not as, I feel like probably not as much or as effectively as we should, government money there, but there need to be diversity of options in that world as well. And there really aren't. There are pretty limited options in that world. And then thinking about stepping out of that, there's such a gap for folks, like between total subsidy and support into something that would be a little bit more stable, that it feels like a really sticky wicket to
untangle. That's the hard spot right there. You just identified that the really tough spot is people that are, they're making it, but they're not really making it.
Yeah.
And one of the great statistics that is key to remember is that in the last numbers I think we have are from 2022, the median wealth of a renter in the United States was $10,400. The median wealth of a homeowner in the United States was $396,200.
Yeah.
So that gap is what we're really talking about, the opportunity gap. And if everybody was great at saving and they could pay rent and take $1,000 a month and put it into a mutual fund or a money market, you know, some savings vehicle, that would be great. But housing is really a forced savings vehicle.
Yeah.
But it's a wealth creation vehicle, and it's the number one wealth creation vehicle for the middle class in our country, and has been.
Yeah.
And it's created this wave of wealth that we are now riding. We are in the wave of wealth that was created post-World War II when we built small houses, we created financing programs, we allowed people the opportunity to get started. And that has created this generational wealth that we're now surfing, but the wave behind it is not there. And that's what the younger generation is looking at. They're saying, hey, you guys have this beautiful wave right now, and there's nothing for us on the back end.
Yeah.
90% of us can't afford to get into a house.
Steve, tell us a little bit about how Utah's different. Talk to us a little bit about the growth that we're experiencing here. I'm noticing there's an anti-growth sentiment in our state.
Definitely.
At the same time that our growth is moderating. You know, right now our state's growing at about 1.3%. And we used to grow at 2. But we're still growing.
We're still growing. And we've had explosive growth, I think, is really a way to think about it. And there's some areas in our state that are still growing in explosive ways. But overall, we're slowing down a little bit. But we're so far behind now that we have to be intentional about how we catch up. I think about Utah as sort of, you know, we used to be, and in the 80s, 90s, we were kind of the ugly duckling, right? Everybody was anxious to get out of here. Like you got out of Utah, you succeeded. Like you left and like you made it, you know, you escaped.
I mean, it's not North Dakota,
this is my home state,
but we did have 7 consecutive years of more people moving out than moving in the 80s.
And that was our greatest export, was our kids. And now we're on the other side. We're this beautiful swan. We have this amazing economy. Our GDP has quintupled in the last 25 years. I mean, we're incredibly successful, wealthy. We're number one. You'd look at every publication, we're like, oh, we're the best.
But except for women's equality, but go on.
But in almost all things.
In almost all things.
And I agree with that. But that's brought a challenge in that we are going to continue to be extremely attractive to the rest of the nation and the world. We are an attractive place to come live. And that's primarily because we have this great sense of community. We have people. I have people that I've talked to say, I moved to Park City and it is the greatest family town. And I look at them and I'm like, wait, you're serious? Like Park City? And they're like, yeah, Park City. And for them, coming from New York or Chicago or someplace else, Park City is an amazing family town. Now, to someone who's in other parts of Utah, you'd say Park City is not my idea of the most family town. But that just shows how unique we actually are.
Yeah. And you can't beat our beauty.
Absolutely not.
I mean, maybe Alaska will take a run at it. But
give us your top 2 or 3 solutions to this problem.
I think number one, it's supply. And the best example I can think of for this, it goes back to kindergarten. When you were the kid in the kindergarten lunchroom that had the ding dong and no one else had a ding dong, that ding dong value went from
high
20 cents to now you get $20 for that thing. And housing is the same way right now. We don't have enough starter homes and we don't have enough housing in general. So we have this supply-demand imbalance. And so increasing supply is the foundation of everything that we're doing. We have to meet the demand with supply. And so all of our policies around generating additional supply, in order to do that, we're looking at public lands and talking about state-owned land, UDOT land. These are vacant lots that have been sitting for 20, 30 years. We have schools that are closing. Those should be turned into affordable family housing. Yeah. We have we have a massive amount of public land that is not productive in any way, shape,
could
or form.
Could be leveraged,
And so leveraging that is a huge issue. Creating infrastructure opportunities. We have somewhere around
this is like curb and gutter, water, power, electric.
Yeah. Electric, especially regionally. We have the need in Southwest Salt Lake County for some water tanks. And they span several cities. They span a bunch of developers. So it's a puzzle that is really hard to figure out. That's where I think the state can come in and do large regional infrastructure projects that can unlock housing opportunities.
I think of infrastructure as a proper role for government.
Absolutely. It unlocks, right? That's what I'm, you know, when we talk about what can government do, what's the proper role of government, it is to unlock and level the playing field so the private sector can go in and actually deliver the units.
Shireen, we're about just a minute and a half or so left in the program.
Yeah.
What else should we ask? Because what I'm thinking about is what can all of us do to help?
Yeah.
I mean, Governor Cox can do things.
Yeah.
Our legislature can do things. Why don't you take it?
So I think one of the things that I would ask people to reflect on is I know that this change is hard. And I know it's really hard to see, especially if you're a longtime resident of a community. But I would ask people to try to think about this in a way that's really global. What does it mean for the long-term stability of our state? What does it mean for a family you've never met to be able to build that kind of stability and long-term wealth? And, you know, maybe open your heart a little to the idea of more developments, which is hard. I know it's really hard. But also, if you already are on board, email your legislator, email your county council or your county commissioner, and let them know you want to see more housing.
Yeah. So minute left. Finish this out here, Steve.
I wholeheartedly agree with what Shireen was just talking about. I think there are many that are justifiably afraid of the change. And what I would say to them is that the fastest way to change, and it's not just you know, more houses. It's cultural change. And what are we going to lose? Mm-hmm. And the fastest way we can lose our culture and what makes us special here in Utah is to export all of our kids and grandkids and import all of their replacements. And that's mm-hmm. effectively the decisions that we're making when we don't build starter homes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that happens at a very local level. It is going to your city council members and saying, you know what? Yes, this is hard, but we want you to make it possible for our kids to have owner-occupied starter homes in our community so they can live near us and come visit and have Sunday dinner with us.
Yeah. The benefits outweigh the costs.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's a wrap. Such a great conversation. Thanks, Shireen, for that. Thanks, Steve Waldrop, for joining us, the Senior Advisor for Housing Strategy and Innovation for Governor Cox. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.